main event.
Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
Good morning. How are you? How are you? How are you? This is old Terrible Tommy back in the groove. Back in the groove. We've had some crazy weather back here. And if we get this much water coming down in December like we're having coming down this summer, well, it's going to be Lower Slobovia. If you like Little Abner cartoons and Al Capp, of course, he's been dead for many years. Yeah. It is December, July the 27th, 2015, and it's Moon's Day, and we got another week here. Now let's get into it freshly. We are still ever at P.O. Box 405, 401, Warsaw, Indiana. Have another drink, Metzger. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for everything. I did get a small, but it's not small to a lot of people. Somebody sent me yesterday $25 more for our prisoner fund. So that means some prisoner out there is going to get a little more money. So that's the way that works. I find out from David Tate that they have a setup to where he can get on a computer and email. So I think I'm going to try to set that up and have contact with him that way. I was just about to send out a letter this morning, note and some cartoons I clip out of the newspaper for this. In this case, it was Dennis Mahon who was supposed to be out there at Pekin, Illinois, but I said, you know, I think they're going to move him. I better check before I send this letter out. So I checked the Federal Prisoner Registry, and he's been moved. He's down at Brewston Mills, West Virginia. Actually, the name of the prison is Hazleton Prison, Federal Prison, and I hope he doesn't have problems down there, because that prison is a privately run contract prison where they give the minimum amount possible to the inmates to make maximum profits. There's growing numbers of these prisons all over the country, and they should be done away with. The federal government should control that stuff. Not that they do a great job, but they do better than private prisons. Anyhow, his new address is numbers 30289-424, Federal Correctional Institution. I wonder how much correction they really do. I think the recidivism rate is about 85%, but anyhow, in these prisons, based upon the fact that they can trip you up on your parole so easily over drinking or having a gun or smoking a joint or anything, throw you back in, because it's a profitable deal. Especially these private corporations now, they're making a fortune off this. And, of course, the local people always say, oh, yeah, build a prison in our town. Yeah, so we can employ 25 or 30 guards from our community where there is no jobs. Anyhow, it's at P.O. Box 5000, Brewstown, Brewston, B-R-U-C-E-T-O-N, Mills, West Virginia, 26525. That's P.O. Box 5000, Brewston, Mills, West Virginia, 26525. And we'll have that up on the website in the next day or so, okay? We're going to have to keep old Mahon and some of these guys in some money if it's only to buy bottled water, because most of the prison water is coming from contaminated sources. And West Virginia has been so raped by Murray Mining and all these people. They're destroying West Virginia. I mean, you know, they're cutting off all the tops of the mountains to mine ore and so forth. These guys are, you can't call them war criminals that run these outfits, but they are criminals of the worst sort. These guys that run these mines. I'm going to run you a little thing here. I normally wouldn't do this, but this is about a law that they was putting through in Washington about this bad water and contamination. And there's no place in the country worse than West Virginia.
Laws on coal ash, only 5 of the 25 states surveyed specifically prohibited disposing coal ash into groundwater. The other 20, we don't care, dump it in there, what the hell. You know, you want a drink? Go buy some bottled water from Nestle Corporation. Miss Evans said, quote, "It makes absolutely no sense. It's absurd and unreasonable," the bill the House passed. She noted that even household waste can't be legally disposed into aquifers. You have to have a tie-in to a sewer or a septic tank, but not the coal company's coal ash. Dump it wherever you want. All the arsenic and the poison, screw it, right into the groundwater. Eh? If your next baby is born with 7 heads and webbed feet, well, it's not our fault. Good God, what are you living near our plant anyway? Huh, you sons of bitches? That's not all of it. The bill that the Republicans passed also delays implementation of coal ash disposal restrictions. It allows utilities to avoid publicly posting contamination data. Huh? That's what Cat Mary called the dark. Don't give Americans the right to know anything. And allows companies to continue dumping coal ash into leaking surface impounds for as many 8 years after contamination is documented. I'm going to have to stop broadcasting on the air, Kathy, and switch over to internet, because I get, you know, I want to use the kind of language that this kind of stuff provokes in me, and I can't say it. Allows companies to continue dumping coal ash into leaking surface impounds, like those slurry pits, for as many as 8 years after the contamination is discovered. Coal ash is a byproduct of coal-fired power plants and often contains toxic chemicals like arsenic, chromium, mercury, and lead. It is also the second largest form of waste generated in the United States. Coal ash has earned headlines and increased regulation in recent years, particularly after a massive spill in the Dan River in North Carolina in 2014. One of the most common ways companies dispose of coal ash is by storing it in man-made ponds or lagoons, of which there are hundreds across the country. We'll take a break and be back. I'll see you tomorrow, True Seekers. Take care. Keep listening to your Hillary for President
Hillary Clinton for President file, two major prison companies, private prisons, are serving, or lobbyists for these two major private prison companies, are serving as top fundraisers for Hillary Clinton. Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group could both see their fortunes turning if there are fewer people to lock up in the future. They might not be able to make a profit. Last week, Hillary Clinton and the other candidates, according to The Intercept, they revealed a number of lobbyists who are serving as so-called bundlers for their campaign. Bundlers collect contributions on behalf of a campaign and are often rewarded with certain favors like access to the candidate. Oh, come here, you little sweetie. Richard Sullivan is of the lobbying firm Capital Council, is a bundler for the Clinton campaign, bringing in close to $50,000 in contributions in a few short months. Sullivan is also a registered lobbyist for the GEO Group, a company that operates a number of jails, including immigrant detention centers, for profit. Oh, Ted Cruz and the rest of you sons of bitches, this really makes you jealous. I'll bet Hillary's got a lock on this, you dumbheads. As The Intercept reported yesterday, fully five Clinton bundlers work for the lobbying and law firm Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld. Corrections Corporation of America is the largest private prison company in America, and they paid that group $250,000 in lobbying fees last year. That law firm also serves as a law firm for the prison giant, Correction Corporations of America, representing the company in court. One of the lobbyists in Clinton Bundler is a guy named Brian Popper. He disclosed that he previously helped Corrections Corporation of America defeat efforts to compel private prisons to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests. They don't have to. Thanks to one of the bundlers who is doing a great job for Hillary Clinton. Now, like what Lee Fang, writing at The Intercept, the way he puts it, he says, Hillary Clinton has a complicated history with incarceration. When she was the first lady, she championed efforts to get tough on crime. She said in 1994, quote, we need more police. We need more and tougher prison sentences for repeat offenders. The three strikes and you're out for offenders has to be part of the plan. We need more prisons to keep violent offenders for as long as it takes to keep them off the streets, Hillary said. Now, in recent months, and gee, I wonder why, Mrs. Clinton has tacked left in some ways, and now she calls for alternatives to incarceration and for greater police accountability. Yeah, well, that's because she's running for president as a Democrat rather than running as the fascist that she is. I'm sorry. So's her husband. So's everybody ever worked for him. So what? Big deal. Hey, this is United States of America. Don't worry about it.
Well, that's enough of that, I guess, for now, about the crappy companies that dump all their crap that's much worse than human sewage into these ponds all over the place, and then they leak into the rivers and streams. And down there in West Virginia, people are getting birth defects all the time. They can't drink any of their own water or anything. And then there's Hillary. She's also, they're championing the money-making private prison companies. One time saying, we got to have more laws, we got to shove people in jail, and the next time saying, well, maybe we ought to look at this over. Just please, if you like Terrible Tommy, please don't vote. Please don't vote. You'll sadden me immensely. Like I said in the beginning, we're starting off fresh here this week, and immediately, if you don't get a show from me, get right back to me after you check your spam folder. I think most of you have been getting the show, but I was still getting some shows being bounced back at me towards the end of the week. So we got to get this straightened out. So let me know what's happening. Oh, yes. Thank Mr. PW. He's from Independence, Missouri, that chipped in $25 for the prisoners. Okay, thank you. And thanks to the Seawolf out there for the stamps. We can always use them. Also, congratulations to Seawolf for putting comments on all these websites. And that helps a lot. I wish more of our people would. Positive, good comments, you know what I mean? Incidentally, every once in a while I get a letter from some prisoner who's wanting to get information, and they've been told wrongly by some prisoner who's trying to build his own image that they are a member of WAR, White Aryan Resistance, and they can make you a member of WAR, White Aryan Resistance. So I have to send a letter back when I get something like this to tell them that we do not have memberships in White Aryan Resistance. And for sure, we don't have memberships inside prisons, which there's no security whatsoever for anybody. Anybody could write to me, a nigger or whatever, and say he's in WAR, and to communicate with him and let him know what's going on. Well, he could go right down the line and stick a knife in some good guy. So we can't do that. So we don't do that. So if you get any mail or contact with a federal or state prisoner and they say they're a member of WAR, well, you tell them that no, there is not. And if anybody said they were making you a member of WAR, they're the enemy, because they're liars and there's no truth in them. So anyhow, just don't forget that. WAR has no membership. No membership cards. No meetings, no rallies, meetings only on a personal basis, one-on-one. We are lone wolves, and we love it. Before we go on with the reading from the Nelson book about the White Knights of Mississippi and Tommy Terrence, and the rest of the crew, I'm going to go into another book here. So to give you a little background on the Jew in the South, and specifically in the Jackson, Mississippi area, where the White Knights of Mississippi were most prominent, and to give you a little idea what they were up against. No, Northerners don't think much about Jews in the South. I remember in that movie Driving Miss Daisy, where they had the nigger driving the old Jew around, and her son talks about it, us Jews. A lot of wealthy Jews and plantation owners were Jews. But they don't talk about that, do they? On a muggy, overcast Thursday afternoon in October, Macy B. Hart set out from New Orleans in a white Chevrolet van to bury the Dixie Dysphoria. His destination was Donaldsonville, Louisiana, a little town in the heart of Cajun country, the first stop on a long, slow procession through the hamlets of the Deep South. Once Jewish communities had flourished in places like Donaldsonville, but now they were dying, and Macy B. was determined to give them a decent funeral. Nobody assigned him to the burial detail. He volunteered for it because he knew it had to be done and there was no one else to do it. Macy came to the realization gradually. A few years before, he'd heard about an old man in Laurel, Mississippi. Now that's not far from Jackson, who discovered he was the last Jew left in town and uncertain what to do. Took the Torah out of the ark of the small temple and locked it in the trunk of his car. Macy wasn't surprised. For some time, Jewish religious objects had been turning up in the boutiques and antique shops around the South. Historic temples had been crumbling for lack of attention, and Jewish cemeteries had gone. Wait a minute here. Untended. But the Laurel incident made Macy realize that the small town Southern Jewry, as he had known it as a boy in Winona, Mississippi, was coming to an end, and he resolved to help make the demise as dignified and painless as possible. First, he tried unsuccessfully to get Laurel Torah for the Jacobs Camp for Living Judaism in Utica, Mississippi, a summer camp that Macy has run since 69. Then he began to search the boutiques for sacred articles, which he brought to Utica. Gradually, he became determined to create a museum at the camp as a memorial to Southern Jewry and to provide aid to the communities that could no longer help themselves. For months, he had been planning the museum. Now, in the fall of 86, he was ready to set out on a barnstorming tour aimed at making it a reality. I think I'm going to just sort of jump around here because it'd be too monotonous reading all of this stuff. This is from the book Members of the Tribe, which was written by an Israeli Jew. Here's one paragraph that caught my attention. People up north think that the Jews down here were afraid of the Klan, Macy said, and Betty shook her head. I can't honestly say we ever had any anti-Semitism that I knew of. Well, there was this one time when a little nothing boy put a note under our door, but nobody got too excited about it. As we approached Donaldsonville, Betty began to point out local landmarks. She became especially animated when we reached the Sunshine Bridge. The bridge is a monument to the administration of Huey Long, a politician Betty remembers with fondness. Quote, a lot of people had the wrong idea about that man, she said in a challenging tone. He was portrayed as a dictator and all, but he did a lot of good for this state. And I'll tell you something else. He had a lot of Jewish support down here and a lot of Jewish officials in his government. Interestingly enough, he was assassinated by a Jew. But from what I remember, it was more of something of a personal situation more than a political thing. The guy was a dentist, I believe, that shot him. I've stood on the spot where Huey Long was shot inside the Capitol in Baton Rouge. Beautiful Capitol building. You'd think you were in 39 or 40 Berlin. In that place. It's a fantastic, beautiful. If you ever get down to that area, go in there and see that state capitol. I mean, it's got fascist symbols all over it. Looks like German building. Yeah, it's got beautiful woodworking and gold ornaments all over the place. It's fantastic. And Huey Long had that built. I think I just screwed up. I think I left a blank here. I'll tell you, I don't know it's this heat and humidity, I guess. Anyhow, I'm going to read that paragraph again in case it's not on here. As we approached Donaldsonville, Mississippi, Betty began to point out local landmarks. She became especially animated when we reached the Sunshine Bridge. The bridge is a monument to the administration of Huey Long, a politician Betty remembers with fondness. A lot of people had the wrong idea about that man, she said in a challenging tone. He was portrayed as a dictator and all, but he did a lot of good for this state. And I'll tell you something else. He had a lot of Jewish support down here. And a lot of Jewish officials in his government. So even though he was assassinated by a Jew, it seems that he had quite a bit of support from the Jews in Mississippi. It also come out in this book that a hell of a lot of Jews down south joined the Catholic Church as a cover, just like the Marinos did in Spain. Well, here's a little bit about a Jew family. The Harts have deep roots in the south, but they are comparative newcomers. Jews, most of them Sephardim, from the Caribbean and Europe. Usually these are the dark-skinned Jews. They began settling in southern seaport towns in the 17th century and gradually moved inland. Some were merchants, others became planters and farmers, and they took an active part in the political and cultural life of their region. In the 18th century, Judah Tura of New Orleans gained national fame as one of America's first philanthropists, establishing charitable institutions, including the Jewish orphanage where Carroll was raised. 50 years later, Judah P. Benjamin was elected Secretary of the State of Confederacy. We've been a part of things down here ever since the very beginning. Well, you see, you don't get elected to anything like that unless you got a lot of money behind you. So evidently, even by the Civil War, there was gobs of Jewish money in the South. Even before the Civil War, a wave of German Jewish peddlers came south. Many of them stayed, establishing small stores in the towns and hamlets of the region. Later, they were joined by a larger group from Eastern Europe, and those were Sephardics. Together, they formed Jewish communities centered around Reformed temples, tight-knit little enclaves where people knew each other and forged family alliances through marriage. That was the Jewish South of Carroll's boyhood, but it no longer exists. Highways and chain stores and a flagging farm economy have forced the small merchants of the South to give way, and the Jew stores of the region are no longer viable. The sons and daughters of the merchants went away to school in the 60s and 70s and had no incentive to return. Instead, they gravitated to New Orleans, Memphis, Atlanta, and Jackson. The Jewish communities in these cities are holding their own, but elsewhere, congregations that numbered several hundred families only a generation ago are now down to their last few members. As Southerners invariably do, they assured me that things have changed radically since then. I believe they're talking about the 50s. But the memories and scars are still fresh. And Meridian, Mississippi, is a particular symbol of the time when it was dangerous to be a Jew in Mississippi. Back in the 1960s, Meridian had a flourishing Jewish community, self-confident enough to have built an impressive temple, complete with the modern Sunday school wing. But not long after it was finished, the temple was firebombed, and one of the town's leading Jewish citizens received death threats. The Jews of Meridian banded together, raised money, and funded an FBI investigation that led to the capture of the would-be assassins, who included a local grade school teacher moonlighting as a KKK hit person. So they actually raised the hit money to get Terrence and Kathy Ainsworth. Those were the days of high drama for the Jews of Meridian, days that contrast sharply with the present drab reality of the community. It looks like the Klan did the job, because it looks like almost all the Jews moved out of the area. The religious schools built with such optimism only a generation ago stand empty and padlocked. There isn't a single Jewish child left in town. The Meridian Jewish community is coming to its end. Not with a white-sheeted bang, but a whimper. I think the white-sheeted bang helped it along. As we pulled into town, Macy informed me that we would have not one but two meetings in Meridian with the Jews that were still there. Well, I was looking for more information on Jackson, Mississippi, but I failed to find it. It's probably in here, but this is a hard book to read. If you ever want to research this, who the Jews and where they settled all over the country, including the fact that the biggest depository of Jewish information on who the Jews and where they're at in this country is in Iowa. I think it tells in this book where it's at in Iowa. Just a second, let me see if I can find it. Here's a little comment that you might find interesting. Quote, "Money is no problem for us," this Jewess said as we pulled into the parking lot of the Halil. "I'm not out here looking for rich Jews in Iowa. I'm looking for activists. Political science professors can be very good. Rabbis, anyone involved in local politics. A few people in a district like this can make all the difference in the world." He's talking about AIPAC. "People who can make a difference become what are known as key contacts. Ideally, they have a personal relationship with a member of Congress or a senator, or have political chits they can cash on behalf of Israel. Given the extraordinarily high degree of Jewish involvement in politics, it isn't too hard to find key contacts." Lori estimated that AIPAC has them for about 90% of the members of the House of Representatives and 98% of the Senate. There you go. I don't think it's changed much since then. Oh, here's an interesting part of this book. Bruce and Jerry estimated that there are roughly 5.6 million Jews in America, or as they prefer to count, between 2.3 and 2.6 million households. Their computers list the names and addresses of 1.7 million households, approximately two-thirds of the total. "There are no absolute foolproof figures on this," said Bruce. "The only thing we know for sure is that the number of Jews in the country is declining, mostly as a result of intermarriage. It's interesting to note that fewer and fewer of the non-Jewish partners convert. That's a trend. How do you find Jews?" I asked, thinking of Lori Posen's painstaking approach. Bruce and Jerry looked at each other and smiled. "Simple. It's all a matter of names and probabilities." "Exactly," said Jerry, breaking in to finish the thought. "Take the name Cohen, for example. What percentage of the Cohens in this country would you say are Jewish?" A few weeks earlier, I had been looking for Jews in the Midwestern inner city and had come across the name Glorious Cohen in the phone book. When I called, I was informed by an irate Mr. Cohen that he wasn't a Jew and never had been. "Not all of them," I said, recalling that conversation. Jerry seemed disappointed that I had managed to evade his trap. "Right, 86% of the Cohens in America are Jewish, but Cohen is easy. There's 80,000 common Jewish names, each with its own degree of frequency. They match them up with neighborhoods and professions, first names and other indicators, and we get a pretty close to the exact percentages. Take the name Gordon," said Bruce. "It's a borderline name. Sheldon Gordon from Long Island is likely to be a Jew. Bubba Gordon from Tennessee probably is not. It's a matter of probability and common sense." "Right. First names are very important," said Jerry. "Only about half of the Jews have Jewish family names, so we look for Yiddish or Hebrew first names. It's interesting that Jewish yuppies like Hebrew names for their children. Arbit and Benjamin not only find Jews, they try to find out about them. They take a gleeful pride in the information they've accumulated." "What percentage of the Jews have Christian trees?" demanded Benjamin. "Come on, take a guess." 11%? "And what percent keep kosher?" said Arbit, smiling broadly at his partner. "Bet you can't guess that one either." "All right, 22%. "I'm a little skeptical about that one," said Jerry. "The other day I saw a neighbor of mine who claims to be Orthodox at the drive-in window at McDonald's. I think we should start a new category, people who eat McDonald's hamburgers only in the privacy of their own car." But Arbit and Benjamin delight in this kind of speculation, but they haven't built up their data bank to amuse visitors. They sell information about Jews, and to judge their company's rapid expansion, it is a seller's market. They have two kinds of clients, Jewish groups and politicians. and their company is strategically located at the point where the two intersect. Neither Arbeit nor Benjamin is simply a technocrat. AB Data sells mailing lists of all the Jewish organizations, but its owners have their own agenda, and this poses a potential threat to the establishment. Direct mail is the great equalizer, Jerry said in a matter-of-fact tone. We can enable Jews in Montana and Idaho and places like that to take part in Jewish life without an intermediary organization located on the eastern seaboard. We make it possible to bypass the gatekeepers of the Jewish community. The AB Data Agency agenda is based on three principles: Zionism, traditional Jewish values, and American political liberalism. In the fall of 1986, the company was still promoting these indirectly as a resource for politicians and mainstream Jewish organizations. But knowledge is power, and Benjamin and Arbeit are potentially very powerful men. When I mentioned the possibility they might someday create an independent Jewish power center in Fox Point, Wisconsin, they both smiled modestly, but neither one denied the possibility. We interrupted our conversation to take a tour of AB Data's facilities. At the heart of the operation are giant computers that contain the vital statistics on millions of Jews. I found the concentration of so much information disconcerting. Quote, I bet the Klan or the PLO would love to get their hands on this stuff, unquote, I said to Arbeit, who was guiding me through the building, but he dismissed my concern as Israeli paranoia. America doesn't work that way, assured me. Besides, there's nothing here you can't get out of the phone book. Benjamin Arbeit, like the people at AIPAC, view America's current philo-Semitism and political stability as natural and permanent. It's not dangerous to compile Jewish lists because there is no real threat to Jews. Not presumptuous to organize Jews politically because, as Americans, it is their right. Although Benjamin and Arbeit consider themselves Zionists, they do not accept the Zionist notion that Jews are merely guests in America. Much of the AB Data's work is done for politicians who want to appeal to Jews for support and financial contributions, and Benjamin and Arbeit have been exceptionally effective in helping them do it. I mentioned to them that during the Iowa Jew hunt, Lori Posen had asked her audiences if they had contact with Alan Cranston. He was a powerful senator from California. The question always elicited good-natured groans from the people who had been inundated with appeals. Quote, my children should write me as much, unquote. One woman had said in Waterloo, quote, they should send that much money too, laughs Benjamin. We raised $4 million for Cranston in $20 checks. AB Data is picky about its clientele. We have two conditions for working with politicians, said Jerry. They have to be pro-Israel, and they have to be liberal on American issues. Bruce agreed with the first principle. There is no single Jewish community in this country, he said. There are different groups with a variety of ideologies. The only thing that unites them is support for Israel. But he disagreed with the second. Like Jerry, he is a political liberal and Jewish conservative. But he is less doctrinaire of the two and wouldn't be surprising if he occasionally slipped into the McDonald's line at the restaurant. Jerry's a knee-jerk liberal, he said fondly. I consider myself a moderate, and I have no trouble working with candidates who are moderate if they're pro-Israel. In fact, most of AB Data's political clients are liberals. Cranston, Lowell Weicker of Connecticut, Barney Frank from Boston, Jim Hunt, who ran against Jesse Helms for Senate in North Carolina, Carl Levin of Michigan, Paul Simon of Illinois. You see, these people have been out of politics, and most of them are dead for 20 years. Most Jews are genetically Democrats, said Bruce. Jesse Jackson's performance at the 1984 convention was perceived by Jews as the Democrat Party shitting all over the Jews, and they were freaked out by it. Believe me, it's had an impact ever since. The worst response we ever got to direct mailing was one we did to raise money to fight apartheid. Jews in America don't support apartheid, but as long as Jesse Jackson is a major black spokesman, they won't give money on the issue. Still, in spite of everything, they voted for Mondale 3-1. Why? Because Jews in this country, despite what they say, are still basically insecure, and their main fear is the right-wing Christian anti-Semitism. I mentioned to them, I think they're right there. These crazy-ass Christians, if I ever go on the warpath, it's going to be Katie bar the door shut, there's a man under the bed. I mentioned to them that my next stop would be Washington, D.C., where I was scheduled to meet with Ben Waldman. Jerry Benjamin searched his encyclopedic memory of the American political operatives and brightened when he recalled the name Ben Waldman did Jewish political organizing for Ronald Reagan in 84, he said. What's he up to these days? He's in charge of Pat Robertson's Jewish campaign. I said, happy to be one on the AB Data Whiz Kids. They looked at each other with amused wonder. Pat Robertson's Jewish campaign, said Benjamin. Now I've heard everything. In political circles, Ben Waldman is known as Pat Robertson's Jew. It is common usage. I heard other people mention as George Bush's Jew or Jack Kemp's Jew, as if Jews like charter airplanes are standard issue for presidential candidates. Actually, Jews are intensely involved in virtually every aspect of American politics. In 1986, there were 8 Jews in the U.S. Senate from states that were very small Jewish populations, and 28 in the House of Representatives. And in 27 of these 36 senatorial races, at least one of the candidates, and often both, had a Jewish campaign manager or finance chairman. Many of the Jews in politics are professionals who happen to be Jewish and have no particular connection with the Jewish community and its concerns. On the other hand, there are political people who specialize in being Jewish. Some, like the AIPAC activists, lobby for Israel. Others work directly with the candidates as fundraisers or Jewish issues experts. Ben Waldman is the kind of political Jew. In the fall of 1986, there were dozens like him in Washington, but none of them was working for Pat Robertson. I went to see him because I wanted to find out what that was like. We met at a restaurant not far from Capitol Hill. Waldman looks like a kind of Jew Pat Robertson could relate to, a handsome, fair-haired man in his mid-30s. With startling blue eyes and a reasonable patient manner of someone who expects not to be believed. As a boy growing up in Claremont, California, he wanted to become a conservative rabbi. Instead, he went into conservative politics. Waldman's political baptism came during the 1980 presidential race when he ran Ronald Reagan's Jewish campaign in California. That's one of the reasons I keep telling you I never supported Ronald Reagan after the first stint when he ran for governor. I figured him out. You can't believe how much hostility there was, he told me. He went door to door in the Borscht Belt of Fairfax Avenue in L.A. The people spit at us, literally. They said Reagan would be bad for Israel. In 1984, Waldman headed Reagan's National Jewish Campaign, stressing the president's pro-Israel record. It proved to be an inefficient argument. The Jewish voters appreciated Reagan's support for Israel, but the Democrats neutralized it by playing up the influence of the radical right on the GOP, just like they're going to do this election. The church and the state killed us in 84, he said in an analytical tone. It was a negative contest between Jerry Falwell and Jesse Jackson, and we lost. For his efforts in 1984, Ben Waldman was rewarded with a mid-level administrative job in the White House staff, but he was dissatisfied. In August 86, he was contacted by Robertson, who invited him out to his headquarters for a chat. Waldman was impressed. He signed on. There's a lot more interesting stuff on this, but anyhow, these big computer companies with all these Jewish names, all the Jews in the country, they're out there in, I guess it was Wisconsin. So they're getting bigger and bigger all the time. Something to remember. Oh, yeah, here's where the center is. AIPAC deals in political retail, but there is another mass market approach to Jewish political activity. Its improbable center is Fox Point, Wisconsin, a Milwaukee suburb. There, in a blue hangar-like building, two jovial Jewish yuppies named Bruce Arbit and Jerry Benjamin have put together a company called AB Data that may eventually make the Jew hunter as obsolete as the blacksmith. So you don't have a problem finding who the Jews are. Just go out there and buy a mailing list. Yeah. I'd like to visit that place. Maybe you might, somebody up around there might want to visit and check it out. Anyhow, I sort of got off the track here, but it's important information. That book, if you'd like to get a hold of it, probably through one of the Amazon connections. Let me see here. It's called Members of the Tribe. It was published by Bantam Books. And it was copyrighted 1988. So if you'd like to get a copy, a lot of good research material in this book. And I'm sure most of the people who call themselves racial and critical of Israel and Jews never heard of it. Before I proceed, let's go back to our pessimist's guide to history. Yeah. 85,000 years ago, the last ice age, the change probably began with a barely perceptible cooling of the climate that lasted for thousands of years. Then some 85,000 years ago, the temperature finally dropped so low that a great ice age began. Slowly, the thick sheets of ice covering North Pole region advanced southward. As the cold worsened, some 18 million cubic miles of water froze, and the sea levels dropped by 425 feet. North America, Europe, and northern Siberia were largely buried under nearly 2 miles. That's 2 miles of ice. And Asia and North America were joined by a massive bridge of ice. In the southern hemisphere, the South Polar ice cap spread northward to cover New Zealand and the Andes Mountains. By the time the Ice Age reached its peak about 18,000 years ago, ice in the northern hemisphere extended as far south as southern Illinois. In New Hampshire, the 6,300-foot Mount Washington was buried in ice up to its peak. Some areas not covered by ice became vast deserts. Regions of Africa are now rainforests, were covered by sand dunes. By about 10,000 years ago, the ice had largely receded from the western North America, and by 7,000 years ago, the ice age was over. The drastic climate changes during the long ice age devastated the world's animal species. Competition for the reduced food supplies and other factors drove half of the species in Europe and North America into extinction within 20,000 years. Most of the world's large land animals died out, including the saber-toothed cat, a 12-foot-tall kangaroo, a 3-ton sloth, and a 14-ton tusk mammoth. Only in parts of Africa did the large mammals survive. As zoologist Alfred Wallace put it, we live in a zoologically impoverished world from which all the hugest and fiercest and strangest forms have recently disappeared. While it was certainly the latest, this ice age was by no means the only one experienced over the millennium. In fact, there have been 4 separate ice ages in the last 2 million years. The other 3 lasted from approximately 1.6 to 1.3 million years ago, 900,000 to 700,000 years ago, and 550,000 to 400,000 years ago, respectively. One can only wonder if this latest ice age is really the last. The way it looks, it wasn't. Once these things start, population control will be no problem at all. No, if you got 1 billion people on the earth, hell, it may go down to 100,000. Well, let's close out here with Terror in the Night, Jack Nelson's book. A little past 10 p.m. that night, the shock of an enormous explosion shook Al Binder's antebellum home in a fashionable section of Jackson, literally lifting him out of bed. Instantly, the young lawyer was wide awake. Temple Beth Israel was only a half mile away, and because of all the Klan threats against the Jewish community, he immediately figured it had been bombed. He worried about Rabbi Perry Nussbaum, who often worked late in his office. He might be inside the synagogue. Binder pulled on his clothes and drove as fast as he could through the empty streets. Joe Harris, a prominent building contractor, and his wife Maxine also were jarred awake. "Joe, something big just blew up," she exclaimed. "You better get up and see what's going on." As he struggled to get his clothes on, she turned on the radio. At first there was music, but then a bulletin. "Temple Beth Israel has been bombed." "I knew it," Joe had said as he hurried out to his car. "The rabbi is going to get us all killed." Binder was the first to reach the scene. The night was dark, with warm mist hanging in the air. The smell of dynamite stung his nose. He looked around and saw no other cars in the parking lot, no lights shining in the synagogue. Maybe the rabbi had not worked late after all. Police cars, ambulances, and fire trucks arrived, sirens screaming. The spotlights of the emergency vehicles illuminated the building. The blast had ripped through the administrative offices and a conference room, tore a hole in the ceiling, blown out windows, and ruptured a water main and buckled the wall. An octagonal structure dominated by a massive roof, Temple Beth Israel had been dedicated only 7 months earlier. Now Binder could see smoke coming from the windows. Scores of neighborhood residents, some of them in bathrobes, were beginning to collect on the lawn. The night was so dark and foggy that people in the crowd had difficulty recognizing one another. Standing in groups of two or three, everyone spoke in whispers, as though talking aloud would violate somebody's already defiled, something already defiled by everyone assumed had been a bomb. Over and over they asked one another, "Why would anyone do such a thing?" The crowd opened a path for Rabbi Nussbaum and his wife, Irina. The Nussbaums, too, had been awakened by the blast and were already dressed when the FBI agent Jim Ingram, in charge of civil rights enforcement, I love that term, civil rights enforcement. Yeah, right. Now nervously surveying piles of shattered glass and plaster, Irina said, "Just think what would have happened if someone had been inside there." "Well, I think they'd have been blown to bits." "This is a fear I've been living with," Nussbaum answered. Turning to a local reporter, he added, "I had intended to do some of my work in my study tonight, but changed my mind at the last minute and stayed home." Joe Harris was not the only Jew in Jackson who blamed the rabbi for the bombing. Perry Nussbaum did not have many friends in or outside the congregation. Although well-educated and highly principled, he was tactless, abrasive, outspoken, and headstrong in his views. In other words, a typical Jew. A medium-sized man with thinning hair, a bristling mustache, and horn-rimmed glasses, he had a way of irritating people from the moment he met them. He liked to fire verbal darts, abrupt comments, and he seemed to think they were funny, but others found inappropriate or even rude. Soon after arriving in Jackson from Pittsfield, Massachusetts in 1954, Nussbaum had sized up the modest two-bedroom starter house Al Binder lived in and then declared condolencingly, "I guess you're good for the minimum," meaning the young lawyer could afford a $5 weekly contribution to the synagogue. Irina, who tried to pass off the rabbi's remarks as just Perry's sense of humor, told Binder her husband was trying to be funny. Binder did not find it funny. the night Nussberg met Elaine Crystal, wife of business executive Emanuel Crystal, the rabbi provoked an argument by saying that he was going to downgrade the role of Hadassah, the Jewish women's organization, in the temple's Israel activities. Hadassah would have to hold its meeting someplace else. Elaine Crystal, an outspoken woman, told the rabbi and the temple congregation was so small it needed all the support it could get from the Hadassah and other Jewish organizations. When she got home, she telephoned Nussbaum and gave him another piece of her mind and slammed down the phone. The rabbi could not seem to resist needling people. Joe and Maxine Harris had a son whose dark complexion became deeply tanned during the long Mississippi summers. Encountering the boy one day, Nussbaum remarked, "Son, I always knew your mother was a loose woman, but I never thought she'd go this far." Maxine was furious. He managed to insult every member of the congregation at least once. Joe Harris recalled everyone would cringe, wait to see what he was going to say next. "We had always revered rabbis and treated them with great respect. We didn't expect them to always be making wisecracks." Nussbaum not only had a difficult personality, he was still, after more than a decade in Mississippi, seen as an outsider. The rabbi himself had grown fond of the state and its people, an affection that compounded his inner conflict as the civil rights struggle intensified. But he rejected the elaborate strategies that most Jews in the South had developed for dealing with their vulnerable situation. Members of his congregation felt that he did not really understand what it meant to be a Jew in the South. Jews had lived in Mississippi since before it joined the Union in 1817. They had fought on its side when it tried to leave the Union in 1860. Many were proud that a Jew, Judah Benjamin, had been an important figure in Jefferson Davis's Confederate government. Along with other whites, they had supported the prospered from the peculiar institution of slavery in its pure form before emancipation and its covert form afterwards. Yet even when they tried to convince themselves of their acceptance by their fellow Southerners, deep down they always knew they were viewed as aliens in a land of uncompromising, militant, fundamentalist Protestantism. Judaism may rank higher in the moral order of the Bible Belt fundamentalist list circle than, say, Black Christianity or Roman Catholicism, but it remains nonetheless a less than equal sect, an extraneous and foreign religion in an area of xenophobes, Murray Polnar wrote in Rabbi, the American Experience. Incidentally, Judah P. Benjamin fled the country at the end of the war, Civil War. Some say he got out of the country on a private boat with a ton of gold. He went to England and lived a very wealthy life the rest of his days. So he made out of the Confederacy in the Civil War. To thrive, many Jews concluded they had to assimilate into the dominant culture in every way possible, becoming 200% Southerners. They submerged their own religious cultural heritage partly out of a frankly acknowledged appetite for the comfortable life and partly out of fear of violence that never seemed to be far below the surface in Mississippi. Nussbaum's predecessor, Rabbi Meyer Levitt, who had served as spiritual leader of Jackson's Jews for 25 years, understood and supported this approach. He, like most of his generation of rabbis across the South, avoided controversial issues such as civil rights. He downplayed the differences between Judaism and Christianity and supported as much assimilation as circumstances would permit. Jewish holidays were observed inconspicuously, and if Jewish families wished to join the rest of the community in putting up Christmas trees, Lovett made no objection. Maxine Harris remembered Lovett being just like a little Santa Claus. He'd check the Jewish houses to see who had Christmas trees and say, "That's a nice little Hanukkah bush." There never was any trouble with Rabbi Lovett. All over the South, the Jews, especially the dominant assimilationist-minded German Jews, adopted Southern ways while not completely abandoning their old world rituals. They went to their Reformed temples on Fridays, but they shunned the Hebrew chanting and did away with the bar mitzvahs. Kosher kitchens survived almost exclusively in the homes of Jews from the Eastern European roots who arrived later. These are the ones that Hitler wanted to keep out, and the Ashkenazim German Jews wanted to keep out too. So they followed them. These Jews followed the Ashkenazim over here to Mississippi. In the provincials, Eli Evans described a not untypical Sabbath celebration in a Reform household in Anniston, Alabama. First, Mama blessed the lights, and then we always had our favorite Sabbath meal, oyster stew, steak, ham, or fried chicken. Mama's homemade biscuits and cornbread, too. Hoppin' John and sweet potato pie for dessert. Nussbaum had sought to change all that. He criticized those who put up Christmas trees. He reinstituted bar mitzvahs and other Jewish ceremonies. He embraced Zionism and Israel, both of which Southern Jews had traditionally held at arm's length. He insisted openly that Judaism was a distinct religion and not just an earlier Old Testament form of Christianity. The Jewish Church, as many people in Jackson often called it. Although in large ways and small, he made the congregation more aware of its Jewishness, and he made that Jewishness more conspicuous in the larger community, neither of which the members of the Temple Beth Israel welcomed. Nussbaum's personal manner and his approach to Judaism had only compounded what bothered the congregation most about him. The rabbi was just too liberal on the race issue, and much too close to the civil rights movement for all but a few members assigned to congregations in the northern United States for most of his career. Nussbaum, right from the start, had aroused concern among Beth Israel's leaders about where he stood on race. Although he had given them a reassuring pledge never to do anything that would cause problems for the congregation, over the years he had done a series of things that caused some members to worry. They feared his activities would put a spotlight on the Jewish community, antagonize the Jackson establishment, and disturb the uneasy peace the Jews throughout the South struggled to maintain with the Christians who dominated their society. As it turned out, the warriors were right. With Perry Nussbaum, according to his life and nature, it could hardly have turned out otherwise. And that's it for today, boys and girls. We'll be back with you tomorrow on Thursday. And there's a blank in this show someplace. I'll play it back and see, but don't get excited. You're dealing with an amateur. Even though I've been at this for a long time, I still screw up. I don't have a Jew engineer. I don't have a nigger engineer. I don't have a... there's a lot of things I don't have. But we get along. We get along. And hopefully this problem with some of the people not getting their show is solved. Bye-bye, 14-5.
There ain't no man gonna invade my territory. There ain't no desperate and hungry and got nothing to lose. Yeah, I'm alone. I've been chased. I've been bit. Yeah, I'm alone. They like to shoot at me, but they miss. Yeah, I'm alone. And I ain't never been trapped. And God help the people. I've been running since I was three. Born in a Louisiana swamp, moved with the pack to Tennessee. Raised by black and white dogs to some country, some rock and roll. They said, now boy, you're gonna have to quit your howling soul. Staying up all night and chasing lassies by the moon. Lay